If you like, go ahead and open your Bibles to Matthew 22. And then put a bookmark there. And then turn over to Deuteronomy 4. Kind of an interesting thing happens for me as a teacher, preacher, whenever I talk about familiar themes. There's always the risk of us checking out mentally whenever we hear a familiar theme, or we immediately begin to recall all the sermons that we've heard. And maybe if we're paying close attention, we might wonder, okay, I wonder where this guy's going to go with this, and is he going to point this out, and is he going to point that out? But I say all that hoping that you won't do it this morning. Not because I want your attention, but because the very subject matter that I want to cover this morning has this kind of negative dynamic built into it. And that is, everybody thinks they're doing it, when in reality, almost no one is. So that's what I don't want us to do this morning. I want us to be able to hear it as much as possible with fresh ears and fresh understanding, and really ask the Lord to speak to us and give us the truth about this matter. Okay? In Matthew 22, Jesus is approaching the end of his ministry. The cross isn't too far away. I'm not exactly sure, but I think it's just a few days away. And for the longest time, the Pharisees, Sadducees, scribes have been trying to discredit Jesus, trying to catch him in some kind of trap. It's becoming increasingly difficult because of his popularity. He's winning the hearts of the crowds, and now what they're getting down to is we have to trap him in his language. We have to be overly analytical of his doctrine and theology and try to pick it apart the best we can. It's interesting that that still goes on today, you know. But anyhow, they send in the lawyers trying to catch Jesus in his language. And Jesus is approached by a lawyer, or sometimes it says that he's approached by a scribe. The Pharisees have kind of blown their cover, and they're kind of a half a step back from the situation, and now the really intellectual, smart guys are going in trying to trip Jesus up. And after a series of parables and stories, and after a number of descriptions of the kingdom likened unto a marriage, a lawyer addresses Jesus and says, "Jesus, what is the greatest commandment?" And in that whole context of marital love, Jesus, in verse 36, well, in verse 36 they start, "Teacher, what is the great commandment in the law?" Verse 37, Jesus says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." Now, in typical fashion, Jesus gives a response and an answer that's just so perfect, it ends the conversation. But what Jesus was actually doing, he was actually going back to the law, and he was actually speaking from Deuteronomy 4. If you want to, go ahead and turn there. Actually, it's mentioned a few places throughout the Old Testament, but it's spoken of mostly in Deuteronomy 4. 4 and even 6, and then later on even in chapter 30. So, Jesus wasn't saying anything new to them at the time. This was what he's speaking about loving the Lord with all your heart, soul, and strength. This was very, very common language of the day. But Jesus revisits the subject. When he's challenged and when he's asked, what is the most important thing that we need to give our attention and time and energy to, Jesus says this: it's to love God. And he's saying that literally all of the law and prophets hang on this commandment. We'll talk a little bit more about that in just a minute. starting in verse 21, we're going to read about 10 verses. And I want to do that just to set the context of this language and see how, just to get a little bit of a feel for what the Lord is saying. Moses is speaking, and he's speaking to Israel. Israel is about to obtain the promise of walking into the promised land, and Moses is taking a last opportunity to remind them about the things that the Lord has said and to prepare them for going on into the promised land. Let's pick it up in verse 21. And Moses is speaking, and he's speaking about himself. He says, "Now the Lord was angry with me on your account, and swore that I would not cross the Jordan, and that I would not enter the good land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. For I will die in this land. I shall not cross the Jordan, but you shall cross and take possession of this good land." Now listen to this. He says, "So watch yourself that you do not forget the covenant of the Lord your God, which he made with you, and make for yourselves a graven image in the form of anything against which the Lord your God has commanded you." Now you hear that. They're about to cross over and take possession of the land, and Moses says, be careful. Pay attention. You know, why does he bring that up? Why does he say in verse 23, "Watch yourselves that you do not forget the covenant"? Moses knew that it would be very easy for them to forget the promise and slip off into kind of an apathy and indifference, and eventually be overly influenced by the culture that they were moving into and give their heart over to some other god. Verse 24, "For the Lord your God is a consuming fire, a jealous God." Notice right there, he's speaking about the commandment that God gave them. He says he's given this land to you because of promise. It's your inheritance. And now you're going to step over into it. Be careful. Be careful that you don't go astray. Okay? Don't let that culture you're going into influence you. Why? For your God is a consuming fire, and he's a jealous God. He wants an exclusive relationship. Verse 25. "When you become the father of children and children's children, and have remained long in the land, and act corruptly, and make an idol in the form of anything, and do that which is evil in the sight of the Lord your God, so as to provoke him to anger." You see what Moses is doing there? He's warning them to pay attention and to not be distracted. But then he goes on in verse 25 and he says, "But you're going to do it. Here's what you're going to do. You're about to inherit the promise, but here's what you're going to do." And he warns them. And then verse 26, "I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that you will surely perish quickly from the land where you are going over the Jordan to possess it. You shall not live long in it, but you will be utterly destroyed. The Lord will scatter you amongst the people, and you will be few in number among the nations where the Lord drives you. There you will serve gods, the work of man's hands, wood and stone, which neither see nor hear nor eat nor smell. But from there you will seek the Lord your God, and you will find him if you search for him with all your heart and with all your soul. When you are in distress and all these things have come upon you, in the latter days you will return to the Lord your God and listen to his voice." That's key. "And you will listen to his voice. For the Lord your God is a compassionate God. He will not fail you, nor destroy you, nor forget the covenant with your fathers which he swore to them." This is what he's speaking to them as they're about to cross over. He says, pay attention, but you're going to trip up, and here's what's going to happen to you. And then when it happens to you, here's how you fix it. And here's why you can fix it. Because your God is extremely compassionate, and he's made a promise to your fathers. And once he made a promise, it's going to be fulfilled. But notice on the front end, there's the invitation to cooperate with it and to be careful and obtain it. They didn't have to fail. But even though they're going to fail, I'm still going to give you the promise in time. Okay? Now, flip on over to chapter 6. And I encourage you, by the way, chapter 6 is in Deuteronomy is just tremendous. You can read the whole thing, but we're going to focus on 9 verses. We'll start in verse 1. Now, this is the commandment, the statutes and the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded me to teach you, that you might do them in the land where you are going over to possess it, so that you and your sons and your grandsons might fear the Lord your God, to keep all his statutes and his commandments which I command you all the days of your life, and that you and that your days may be prolonged. O Israel, you should listen and be careful to do it, that it may be well with you, and that you might multiply greatly, just as the Lord your God of your fathers has promised you in the land flowing with milk and honey. Notice that. He says, O Israel, listen and be careful to do it. Why? That it may be well with you, and that you would multiply. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons. Which words is he talking about? All of the Old Testament? Or is he saying, hey, listen to this last address that I'm making to you, this last parting remark about being careful and paying attention and to listening. He goes on, he says, when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise up, you shall bind them as a sign on your hand and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. You shall write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates. What's Moses saying? Moses has this parting remark for them. They're about to obtain the promise. He's not extremely confident that they're going to do it right the first time. And he's saying, your God is a jealous God. He's made you a promise. And because of that, pay attention, be careful. And then he goes on to speak about diligence. Now, it's my opinion that two things. I believe Moses was saying this because there's a propensity within the human heart to become casual. And Moses was speaking to them and saying, if in fact you are going to obtain that promise and you're going to be successful in that land, here's the heart posture that you're going to have to obtain it. It's a guaranteed promise from the Lord, but it comes with a condition. And the condition is, you got to be in the right posture to walk it out. Because if they don't have the right heart posture, what do? They immediately turn their heart over to images, to idols that are made with hands, that do not eat, smell, see, or hear. That's going to be your tendency. That's your propensity to go that way. And he's saying, be careful that that doesn't happen. And I think Moses is saying, be careful, and he's making a note of it because it is so easy to do it. It's so easy to slip over into it. And then he speaks a little bit about the diligence. He says, when you wake up, when you sit down, when you're at lunchtime with your kids, when you're on the way, when you're walking into town, put it on your doorpost, write it on your hand, hang it around your neck. Be diligent in this. Okay? So, now you can go on and read in chapter 30. It's there in your notes. It's much of the same language. But I wanted to give you the background that Jesus is speaking from when he's challenged in Matthew 22 when he says, Jesus, what is the greatest commandment? Immediately, Jesus refers to Deuteronomy 4 and Deuteronomy 6. Isn't it interesting? I think it is that here are the Jewish leaders of the day challenging Jesus, and he gives them the answer that they should be doing themselves. It's like, you guys know this. You know the answer to this. Here it is. It's Deuteronomy 4. It's Deuteronomy 6. it's diligence, it's carefulness, and if you were doing it, you wouldn't be asking me this question right now. But because you're not doing it, you're trying to pick me apart. I mean, in essence, that's what he's doing. So to me, it's interesting that Jesus answers their challenge with, you might put it this way, a play from their own playbook. You guys know this stuff. But you can see exactly what Moses was fearful of had happened. The heart of Israel was so changed and had slipped away and wasn't really walking in the promise that even when the fulfillment of that promise, the Messiah walks up and looks them in the eye, they can't see it. Now, here's one of the things I want to put out there to you today. How many people in Israel intended for that to happen? Nobody did. In their own genuine pursuit of the Lord, what happened? They digress. Okay? Here's what I'm getting at. Sincerity is not enough. Moses didn't make the statement that providing that you mean well, you'll obtain the promise. No, you got to be diligent. Okay? You got to be diligent. This has to be in the front of your thinking all the time. You cannot let up on this. Your heart is prone to wander. It wants to do other things. And loving me with all your soul, mind, and strength is not a natural thing. But it can be done if you give yourself to diligence. And here's how you do it. And he's basically speaking about a conscious decision to engage with the Word. Okay? The first commandment is the primary thing with which God is concerned. That is precisely what the Holy Spirit is saying to the church worldwide every day and every season. It's interesting, the prophetic camp that we're in, it's a bit of a prophetic place. We're often asked, what is the Lord saying? And Mike kind of chuckles at it. He's saying, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. The Lord's always saying that. Always and forever. Now, I realize there are seasons where, you know, things happen in the natural and changes and shifts in government and economics and stuff like that. But that is always going on. And that's the first commandment. The first commandment, loving God with all our heart, is the first thing to God and to the prophetic church. Loving God is a glorious end in itself. Okay? Why is the commandment to love the first commandment? The very fact that we were created by a God who is love, the very fact that we were created by Him and He is love, that, if you can say it this way, that spiritual DNA is in a part of our creation. I mean, His fingerprints of creator love, that fingerprint is going to be on everything that He touches and everything that He does. Love is not something that He chooses to do on occasion that He grants or withholds. No, He is love. It's like saying the sun sometimes chooses to be hot. No, it's always hot. That's what it is. Well, the sun sometimes isn't as bright. No, the sun's always bright. The sun is what it is. You can't influence, affect it. You can't change it. There's circumstances that can make our experience with it different, like the rotation of the planet, cloud cover, sunglasses, whatever, sunscreen. There's things we can do in our own circumstance, our own experience, to alter our experience with it. But the sun's always the sun. It does what it does. It is what it is. And our Creator, who is love, everything that He is and does is love. Even judgment. Judgment is not a contradiction to love. No, judgment comes because of love. By the way, this is a bunny trail, but I want to address it for just a minute. Because God's end time judgments at the end of the age are not a contradiction to the fact that He's love. Actually, because He's chosen to be love. He is love, and he has a group of people on the earth who have said yes to that love, and they've chose righteousness and chose to serve him. Out of jealous love, the judgments come. The judgments of God at the end of the age is a judgment against everything that stood in the way of love. That's what the end time judgments are. He's upset that his wife, the Lamb's wife, has been treated this way. And he brings judgment on it. I'm upset about the way you've treated my people. I'm upset about the way you've treated my son. See, even that, even the judgment's rooted in love. Because he's love, it touches everything. He can't act apart from that. So the judgments are a contradiction. Okay, end of bunny trail. The one thing that God wanted all along was the issue of voluntary love. We were created so that God would have a group of people who responded back to him voluntarily of their own free will and said yes to him. That's what he wanted all along. Okay? There's four areas that this verse speaks about. It says, with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. This is a part that we have the potential to skim over. One thing I've learned in the last couple of years, being in the environment that we're in, these people that we run with, they have sat and meditated and looked at that word over and over and over. And it's amazing what happens when you camp out and you stare at it and you don't have that casual reading. So many more things pop out, and so many details, and so many things come out of that word. Okay, but we tend to read the Bible much like we do a novel or a magazine article. Okay, but that's not the way it was written. You know, it was written as a transcription of God's heart. It's a love letter to people. But one of the things that happens is when we encounter this verse and we read with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength, we kind of minimize it. We don't really understand what it means. We kind of generalize it and we move on. But I want to talk about it for just a minute. When the Lord said, here's how I want you to love me, and here's what I want you to be diligent about, and here's what I want you to fix your mind on, I want you to love me with all your mind. What was behind that statement, and what was the motivation of his heart when he said such a thing? How is it that we love God with all of our mind? How do we do that? We don't even think about it much. I'm just going to ask the question, and I want a couple people to respond. How do we love God with all of our mind? Okay. Okay. Oh, yeah. Fix your mind on him, or fix your mind on things above. I think the verses, let's just take those things right there. Fixing your mind on things above, meditating on his word, and purifying thoughts. Okay? So if we use all of our mind to do those three things, what does our life look like and how much time is spent doing it? If we're using all of our mind to purify our thoughts or to have pure thoughts, does that mean most of our thoughts? Does that mean all thoughts about God or all thoughts that fall in the context of spiritual things? Does that mean when I think about it, or when I'm not doing it well and I feel the conviction of needing to do it well, I give some attention to it? See, I'm being a little bit ornery right now, but I'm saying we don't give much thought to what it means. What does it mean to love the Lord with all of our mind? Well, I think the three things that were brought up are great. But to what degree do we do that, and how often do we do it, and what does our life look like when we do it? Here's what I'm getting at on the issue of the mind. I think our minds are so undisciplined and out of control that the thing that the Lord said when he said, "Love you, love me with all your mind," is totally inconceivable to us. I'm saying because of an undisciplined mind that runs wild, it doesn't have a grid to receive what the Lord meant in that verse right there. I think it's very possible and very appropriate for our mind to be fixed on things above every moment that we're awake. And that's not a boredom. And I believe it's very possible. I got really into this whole thing about taking every thought captive for a season in my life when inappropriate things would enter my thinking and dealing with them right then, and being convinced that if I disciplined my mind in that area for a while, that in time those thoughts would be taken captive. And you know what? They were. I remember having to go through this 2-minute rebuke every time they would come, 100 times a day. And thinking, am I ever going to get anywhere with this? But you know what? Then that was reduced to 50 times a day. And then it was reduced to 12 times a day. And then it was reduced to 1 minute a day. And after about 6 months of that, you know what it became? No. Instead of the 2-minute rebuke, it became no. Not going to go there. That's what it became. You can actually discipline your mind. Now, what am I doing in that case? What I'm saying there is I don't want to use my mind in that way. I want to love the Lord with my mind in this moment. And I'm agreeing with the Lord, with His leadership and His Word to such a degree that I'm going to discipline my mind and have proper use of my mind. That's loving the Lord. It's not just pouring out praise and thanks unto the Lord that is loving Him, although it does include that. It's also saying, what you're saying here is right. This is good leadership. I agree with you, Lord. I'm going to do this. I'm not going to be casual about it. I'm going to be diligent about it. Can you imagine what it would be like to walk through life every day and have a mind that was disciplined, focused, didn't run wild, and it was engaged with the Lord all the time? And here's the other thing. Your work, family, and social life doesn't have to change for that to happen. I mean, I've went through seasons of it where my mind is fixed on things above, right in the middle of a conversation with my wife. It's not that everything else has to be pushed aside. I don't know how that happens with the Lord, how you can do things in the natural, but your spirit's engaged with things above. We tend to think it's one or the other. And we tend to think, well, okay, loving the Lord with all my mind is meditation. I do that for 30 minutes in the morning. No, I mean, the very definition of meditate itself means ongoing. It's by very definition, meditation isn't something that you touch a moment or two. It literally means to fix your mind and to focus on and to gaze on. Beloved, we can do that. I realize that we have things to do. I realize there's the grocery list, but even in the midst of the grocery list, we can be gazing into the things above and fixed on those things. You can do that. Now, I get these little supernatural encounters with the Lord every once in a while where He opens my eyes to something and He drops some kind of bomb on me for a day or two and then leaves me to figure out what happened. And I learn more over the next month or two about what just happened. There was a period a couple of months ago where for about 2 days, I saw into the spirit and many situations that I was in and was removed from the natural and could hear the supernatural influence behind comments that were made. And it not was only conversations, but I noticed it also at the magazine rack and the billboard and all of that. And for about 2 days, my eyes were open to it all, and I realized how immersed we are in the spirit of the age, and that we in fact do lie under the power of the evil one. That verse says the whole world lies in the power of the evil one, and we're in it. We're totally surrounded by the influence and the power of the evil one, and the Lord's saying, it's just like you guys going over into that promised land. There's a bunch of people over there that's going to pull you into idolatry. It's going to win your heart over, and if you're not diligent, you're going to get pulled into it. And that's no different than the situation that we're faced with right now. We're in a land that's full of idolatry, that's full of wickedness. And the Lord's saying, come up out of all that. And here's one of the things that you need to do, is to pull your mind up out of it and fix your mind on things above. Okay, but even right now, we're still having a hard time. We don't have the grid right now to even receive what I'm saying. Even what I'm saying right now isn't sinking in. Even right now. We've gotten so used to spending our mental energy in a certain way of what I'm saying sounds either one, extreme, two, impossible, or three. I'm not sure that verse means that. Okay, then what does it mean? Somebody give me a definition of what it means to love the Lord with all of your mind. Think about that word all for a minute. What part of your mind is not included in all? I mean, it's such an encompassing word. So the Lord's saying, there's not a part of your mind that's free for you to use it how you want. That's what that's saying. I'm asking for full, exclusive rights to your mind. That's huge. Okay, let's move on. Enough of that. You're starting to get the point. He says also, he says, love me with all your soul. What's the difference between mind and soul? It's really kind of hard to pin down. And I don't want to go into that. I'm not even sure if I started that discussion, I could finish it. But soul, I'll put it this way. Most of what I read about it, soul has to do with the intellectual part of our brain that's connected to emotions. Meaning, it's a decision that you make connected to an emotion. Okay, or you could put it this way, it's the will. I do what I do because I desire such and such. Or because I love my kids, I spend this time with them. Or out of a desire for my spouse, I do this. I mean, we make decisions all the time that's not necessarily connected to emotion. It's just the right thing to do. You know, I mean, you stop at a stoplight, why? You made a decision, why? Because the light's red. It wasn't because, oh, I desire to obey traffic laws. You know, so we make decisions all the time that aren't connected to will. What's this saying? Jesus is saying, the Lord was saying in Deuteronomy 4 and Deuteronomy 5, 6, when I'm asking you to love me, and I'm asking you to love me with all your mind and all of your soul, I'm asking that your emotions are rooted in love. Love for me, and out of that, you make right decisions. That's what he's saying. So now we've got the mental discipline of fixing our mind on things above, and we're asking the Lord to come change our emotions so that the decisions that flow out of those emotions are decisions that are righteous and full of love. You see what I'm saying? Hitler had emotions, and he acted on those emotions. You see what I'm saying? Jesus had emotions, and they led to action. That's what the Lord's saying here. That's that part of that decision part of your soul, that decision-making part of your soul that's connected to emotion. I'm asking that you would love me with that part of your makeup. How do we do that? I'll get to that later, but I'll just give you a little hint. You ask the Lord to change your emotions, and He will. In time, when you subject your thinking and your heart to the Word of God, in time your emotions will change. Here's the wrong way to go about it. Lord, I'm angry. Would you deliver me from anger? That's how everybody prays. But really, the biblical solution is that you have your mind renewed and your heart changes, and the right prayer should be, Lord, I want to grow in love. When you grow in love, then you don't manifest anger. But we tend to say, I see the problem, Lord, remove the problem. And it's that whole thing about the purity of the well. You see what I'm getting at? All right. He also says, with all your heart. I kind of got that order messed up. He says, with all your heart was the first thing. I'll just jump on it right now. What's he talking about? He's talking about that emotional aspect of our life, that passion thing of our life, that whole thing that's in here that's hard for us to describe, that touches us so deeply. He's asking for us to love him in that way as well. When we mention love the Lord with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength, our thought goes to be really sincere and energetic in worship. I mean, that's where our mind goes. But the Lord is saying something so much more comprehensive and in-depth than that. The Lord's actually saying, the way that I created you and all the complexities of your mind, your will, your emotions, your passions, the fact that you're a man, the fact that you're a woman, all of that makeup, I'm asking you to use that to love me fully. Here's one way that I'm getting a hold of that just a little bit more. In the last couple of years, as Rhonda and I have moved more towards giving our life over to preaching and the pursuit of the Lord, I'm thinking about what it means to actually be a messenger and what it means to live for speaking the Word of God. And I'm so dissatisfied with much of the preaching that's going on today, not because of the context of the message, although that's part of it, but I'm not hearing many messengers. I'm hearing people who have learned how to do a Bible study and make a public address. That's what I'm hearing. And then I heard Jonathan Edwards say this. Jonathan Edwards made some promises to himself about his life, and he wrote them out, and he held himself to them in a strict degree. And Jonathan Edwards saw himself, now this was true of John Wesley as well, but Jonathan Edwards saw himself, his body, his mind, his emotions, his will, and all of his resources as part of the tool to preach the gospel. Jonathan Edwards literally did not see the fact that he had a life of his own to be spent. He literally saw himself as like a screwdriver or a hammer in the hand of the Lord. And this thing that I call my life is to be used in that way. So far that he made this statement, I will neither eat nor drink anything that does not directly contribute to the preaching of the gospel. What? What do you mean you're not going to eat or drink anything that does not directly contribute to the preaching of the gospel? Jonathan Edwards did not feel comfortable with recreational eating. That's not what my body's for. My body is to preach the gospel. And I'm only going to put into it what's necessary to preach the gospel. He had no place for alcohol. Not because, you know, of the possible abuse, but it's not necessary to preach the gospel. He had an extremely disciplined life, early to bed, early to rise. Why? So many hours are needed for study and preparation and preaching. And if I'm tired, I get dull and a lack of power comes on my words. He slept according to his body preaching the gospel. And I'm getting a little bit more of that on my life now. Okay, and that's what the Lord was looking for. I'm just really just starting to brush up against it. I'm not even broke into it and far from even walking it out. But I'm really getting to see the fact that I'm not preaching because I like to. I'm not preaching because somebody needs to hear it. I have a life, I have a body, I have a mind, I have a will. And I'm ready for that to be used to proclaim the truth. Not develop sermons, not develop a ministry, but to actually spend a life. I'm ready to spend my life currency on the Lord. And you know what? Life is so much better. Because now I don't have all these expectations that aren't getting met. Anyhow, that's another bunny trail that I promise I won't go down. Okay, let's turn the page. I want to talk about this commandment for a little bit. And remember, I kind of packaged this at the beginning that there's this potential to miss the comprehensiveness and the depth of what the Lord was saying. But the Lord couched it in this language. He said, all of the law and prophets hang on this one thing. It's also, of the Ten Commandments, it's the first. He's saying, if you do this, you're going to fulfill everything that I've said to you so far, if you'll give your life to this one thing. Great is not the same as first. First speaks of priority. Great speaks of its content. That is, it's great for the human heart. The commandment is twofold. It is the number one priority for us, and number two, it's the greatest thing for us in its content. First speaks of the part that the Lord receives from us. Great speaks of the part that's for us. In other words, it's the first and great commandment. It's first as in priority. That is, the number one thing in my life, I need to give myself unto the pursuit of wholehearted love. That's for the Lord. And the second part is, as I'm doing that, it's good for me. It's good for my heart. It's good for my soul. It's very satisfying to the human heart to give themselves wholly unto the Lord. See the difference? It's not going to the Lord to get, or, Lord, I need something from you. But the Lord is saying, when you pursue me wholeheartedly, and you give your mind, soul, body, and strength to the pursuit of loving me, you'll be satisfied in every way. There will be nothing left that you're not satisfied in. So it's the first commandment, and it's the great commandment. The second commandment is like it. It's not the first, it's not the fifth, it's not the sixth, it's the second commandment. Now, I want to stress this point for just a little bit, and I realize that I'm kind of preaching to the choir. But overall, in Christendom today, something as simple as what we're laying out here, the first and second commandment, is out of order, and we wonder why we've got the problems that we've got. The second commandment was intended to be second. And we hear every one of you has sat in a church at some time where you heard a plea from the front that was really kind of manipulative and a pressure tactic, and it was all rooted in our need to serve people. You've all heard that. I mean, half the evangelism that we hear about today is trying to motivate you by the form of guilt about people going to hell if you don't open your mouth. Okay? Or we need nursery workers, or we need people to show up on cleanup day, which nobody does. It's the same six people that show up every Saturday. We hear all of that. And here's one of the fundamental reasons why it doesn't work, is because that commandment has been put first. And I'm telling you, that little simple switch has drastic consequences. Now, here's the danger. Nobody thinks that has happened. When we say loving the Lord with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength is the number one commandment. That's number one priority. We love God. Yeah, I get that. The number two is like it. So, if a church is really going after it, they'll go hard in the second commandment, assuming that the first one's happening. Because I'm here, and I confess to be a Christian, isn't the first one really happening? We presume that it's happening. Let me use this illustration to make my point. There's probably a gazillion books written about Christian themes by Christian authors on no telling how much of whatever, okay? And you see these seasons come and go. If you go to the library and look for a book that doesn't just mention the first commandment, but it's a book dedicated to the development of the first commandment being first place in our life. You will not find a book in the bookstore. You will not find a book in the library. We've checked this out. Mike's checked it out. Do you know, of all the hundreds of thousands of subjects that's been written on by the church, not in Jewish writing, not in Gentile writing, not this century, the century before, the century before, the century before, never is there one book in print that is totally focused on and dedicated to the first commandment. Can you believe that? No one has ever wrote about the first commandment being first place. Church growth, 10 tips to a better marriage, all of those things are everywhere. But see, everybody assumes that because I love God and that I'm here and I've said yes, that it's happening. But Moses' words were, oh, you got to be diligent. You have to be diligent. And here's what diligent looks like. You have to sit down with your kids. You have to write this on your hand. You have to hang a note off your forehead. You have to write this on your doorpost. You've got to be about this all the time or it's not going to happen. But if you do it, it'll go well with you, your grandchildren, and your great-grandchildren. You'll prosper. But see, we're all thinking we're doing it. But we're really not. Western Christianity is a consumer-driven religion, and in the West, it's easy to get the commandments out of order. If the first commandment is not first place, then everything else is out of place. If there is not a focus and intention about developing and establishing the first commandment as first place, I guarantee you, there's down the line, it's messed up, it's broke down, it's out of order. And we've developed entire churches how to deal and cope with the disorder. Churches have become a means of entertainment. Because the first commandment's not first place, we got to keep these people busy and occupied to keep them coming back. I'm telling you, if the first commandment was first place, that's all the draw you need. People are fascinated by the first commandment. But because we're not giving our attention to it, and we're out of order, and their hearts aren't satisfied, now we got to come up with all this other stuff. Here's another thing that happens. When the first commandment is not first place and you're not radically pursuing it, you will give your heart to other things. And when that happens, then you've opened the door for depression, all kinds of disillusionment, disappointment, and all kinds of breakdown. Because you're trying to run your life on a whole, almost anything except the first commandment, and it's not working. Why? Because you were created by love. And that spiritual DNA is in you, and until you touch it, your created life is not walking in the thing that it was created for. So you find all kinds of things to try to fill this disorder and fill this disruption that I feel, and it can't. And you never will. And that disorder, that discomfort, and that breakdown is supposed to drive us unto the Lord. Remember, Moses said it's going to happen, and when it does, turn to the Lord. And if you pursue him with your whole heart, you'll find him. Why? Because he's a compassionate, consuming fire. He wants this, but he wants voluntary love that will agree with me and my word to such a degree that I'm willing to discipline my mind, I'm willing to change my emotions, and I'm willing to give all of my strength to it. Okay? Let's move on. Okay, I think I really just read like the rest of that page. Also, I just want to make a little comment about Romans 8:28, the whole thing about trial and hardship. You know, that everything works for the good of those who, you know, who what? Who love God. When your life is set on a course to have your heart firmly rooted in the first commandment, the world looks different. trials look different and how your heart responds to crises is different. When you see that you were created by love and that you were created by a passionate God to be a passionate person, and that if I pursue the first commandment, not only will I be satisfied, but it'll go well with my children and my grandchildren. When you realize that, when crises come, you're not disappointed and disillusioned by it. When hardship comes, you see it all as what's designed to help develop love. Okay, so when we've got the order right and we're actually pursuing the first commandment and we're seeking to make it first place, here's the other thing. You don't even have to obtain it. Just when you've made the switch that you're willing to change your life to come in alignment with it, to get on board and to go after it, just even the going after it, you start receiving the blessing. You don't even have to get there. Just the pursuit of it will do it. But it's amazing to me, the more that I grow in the Word and the more that I grow with the Lord, that I hear Christian acquaintances that I made 15 years ago, and I'm hearing how they view life and how they interpret circumstances and how they interpret their money and their job and all that. And what it comes down to is the first commandment's not first place, and they're viewing everything differently. I'm telling you, marriages have went in the tank because the first commandment's not first place. And they've tried to extract something from their spouse that not only can they not extract it from their spouse, they can only get it from the Lord. But because they're not in the pursuit of that first commandment, they're left with getting it at somewhere else. They were created and designed to have that totally righteous love, and they can only get it one way. And when they're not pursuing the first commandment, they try to get it some other way. Marriages break up over this. Many a people are on an antidepressant because of this. Counselors' couches are full of people because of this. I'm not saying that all counselors would be out of business if everybody was pursuing the first commandment. But they'd be close. It'd be dramatically different than what we have now. Can you imagine? I mean, just for a second. I get excited about this. I really do. Because it's obtainable. One, it's the number one thing that's on the Lord's heart. Number two, it's what's going to satisfy everybody. And number three, 10,000 of our problems will disappear if we get this right. But can you imagine being in, let's say, a church of 200, and everybody in the room, when you sit down with them at a fellowship meal, a worship service, a prayer meeting, everybody in there is radically pursuing the first commandment. And they're reaping the benefits of having their mind fixed on things above. Their emotions have been changed and are right. They're giving the Lord all of their body and all of their mind and attention. Can you imagine what it would be like for a woman to walk into a room and feel the fruit of every man's mind in that room fixed the right way? Can you imagine that? What it would mean to walk into a room with people pursuing the first commandment to such a degree that they've disciplined their mind. It's affecting their relationships, how they're called to service, how they're stimulated in their walk with the Lord, how we relate to one another, how we serve. The sermons that come out of the pulpit, the acts of kindness that are done without being prompted to do so. I mean, can you imagine? Well, can you imagine going to church with 200 people that look like Jesus? I mean, that's that's what it comes down to. I mean, what does that look like? And that's what the Lord's calling us to. And what I want to do today is I want to say is, one, we all agree that it's the first commandment. And I want us to fess up to the fact that it's not happening. And then number three, I want us to be encouraged by the fact that it is obtainable. It's not so far out there and so lofty that you can't even start and you give up on the front end. No, God doesn't command it without making a way for it to happen. The very fact that He commands it is also the enablement to do it. We can do this. Okay? It's the great supply of life. Here's just a few things. It isn't an exclusive list. It's a very short list. That are a few evidences of things that happen in a life that's not set on the first commandment. Todd, how are we doing on time? Right now? Oh, okay. We're going to end right here. All right? We can come back at 2, but I need to end at noon. A vote? Okay. Here's a few proofs that the first commandment may not be first place. Compromise and disobedience. Nobody has to put up their hand. But has anybody ever compromised in their life, in decision making, business, marriage, or whatever, have they ever compromised what they knew to be true about the Word of God? Have we ever been disobedient to what we know is written in the Word or what the Lord ever spoke to our heart to do? Sure it is. Now, what I'm saying is, if the first commandment is first place, then we'll be perfect in every way all the time. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not even talking about obtaining the first commandment. I'm saying just agreeing with the Lord's wisdom and leadership in it, acknowledging that we're not there, and then realigning our life to get there the best we know how. Okay? But what I'm saying is your life marked by frequent cases of disobedience or compromise? If the first commandment is not first place, then that's going to happen. Okay? Second commandment is one of the first things that flows out of a first commandment. Jesus said the second commandment is like it, to love your neighbor as yourself. Are we loving our neighbor? Well, you know, we've shown love on occasion. We've actually done some pretty remarkable things on occasion. But are we loving our neighbor? Are we doing that well? And are we doing it to the point that it's not just something that we slip into from time to time, but our life is marked by loving our neighbor well? That's a real good proof. Here's another good proof. Have you ever noticed... Have you ever noticed how much of a lack of real desire there is to be an evangelist? Have you ever noticed that? There's a few, and we cheer them on. And every once in a while, we get revved up about it. But we almost cringe when we hear somebody challenge us about the issue of evangelism. If the first commandment was first place and you were deeply in love, so much to the point that you've given your mind over to it, you've given your emotions over to it, you don't have any of your heart left back for yourself, you evangelize and you don't even know it. You're talking about the love of your life. But let's be honest, many of us don't witness because either one, we're intimidated, or number two, we're a little bit embarrassed. Fear and embarrassment are not components of love. If the first commandment is first place, you don't have fear or embarrassment about witnessing. Here's the other thing, too. If the first commandment was first place, witnessing would look a whole lot different than what it does now, which is a further proof that we're not really walking in the first commandment. Okay? You guys tracking with me? All right. Lack of service. Love serves. We serve our spouses, we serve our kids because of love. On the rare, rare occasion that I vacuum or take the trash out without being told. I promise you, it's motivated by love. This is for Rhonda. This isn't for me. I mean, I love her, therefore I'll do it. Anytime that you enter into a long-time caregiving situation for a parent or something, that's all motivated by love. Love serves. I mean, love cannot sit still. It can't. All right, so a lack of service. Overwhelmed by trials. I talked about that. Lack of vision or direction. What do I mean by that? If the first, well, I talked to you about it. If you have the first commandment and the pursuit of it, and you realize this is the number one thing that I can go after in life, you've got vision. If you hear what Jesus said, and you hear the words of Deuteronomy 4 and 5, you have a goal for your life. But because we don't hear it, and because we don't set our life in order, and now we've got the first and second out of order, which means the third, fourth, fifth, and sixth are out of order also, and now that we've got total disorder in our life, now we don't have any vision. And how many times have you heard people say, man, I just wished I knew what the Lord wanted me to do with my life. Boy, I'd like to do something for the Lord, I just don't know what. Or I don't know whether I should go over here and do this, or I should go over there and do that. That's what I meant earlier when we're asked about what's the Lord saying. And Mike chuckles and says, here's what the Lord's saying. Love me with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Yeah, but I mean, besides that, I mean, really, what are we supposed to be doing? Mike's response is, Jesus said the whole word is summarized in that. You realize you cannot wear out the pursuit of the first commandment. It will keep you busy the rest of your life. You cannot wear it out. You can't. It's the totality of the word. I mean, it is the summary of the Bible. You can't wear it out. Burnout. Average stay for a pastor in church now, 2.5 years. How come you can only stay at a church for 2.5 years? Because it's got a whole bunch of people in it that aren't pursuing the first commandment. That's why. Well, everybody's burnt out. Everybody's fatigued. You know what it comes down to? Now we're living our life only doing what we have energy to do. There's absolutely no sense of service, duty, diligence, or any of that. I mean, now we only do what we have energy to do or we have a conviction about. Very few people actually serve saying, you know what, I really don't like this, but I love the Lord, and I know what the Lord's got for me right now, and this is what I want to do because of Him. Rarely do you hear that. But I'm starting to get a little bit of it. I'm starting to get a little bit of it, and it's fun. You know what? The first time I put on a vest to go park cars, it's my turn. Everybody's got to do it. You know, but then out in the parking lot between sessions, all the cars are parked, and you're sitting out there by yourself, you begin to feel the pleasure of the Lord. And I realize that the Lord loves it that I'm sitting out in this parking lot with this dorky vest on. He likes this, and I'm starting to feel the pleasure of the Lord. And now you find yourself wanting to do it to encounter the Lord. Not because it's just a job that has to be done, although there are times that that happens. But now you're actually encountering the Lord in that place of service, and now you're wanting to do it because you like the fellowship that you have with the Lord while you're in the midst of it. What if we had a whole church full of people that had that heart? Okay. You guys want to go ahead and wrap up? Or do you want to go on for a little bit? I think I can actually wrap up pretty quick. Okay. If the things listed above are not happening in your life in a regular way, it means that we have given our heart over to something other than the first commandment. you realize that makes us spiritual adulterers when we're giving our heart over to something other than the pursuit of the first commandment. There's no other option. The Lord's asking for spiritual exclusiveness, emotional exclusiveness, mental exclusiveness. And when we give our heart to something to such a degree that it dictates our actions and our thoughts, then we've given it over to something other than the Lord. Okay, I need to clarify something here. You can be a business owner and be passionate about your business and it be unto the Lord. You can do that. I mean, you can serve the Lord and go after Him, and you have a heart that's pursuing the first commandment, and as life unfolds, He gives you this idea about business, and you start a business. You know what I'm saying? That the wrong reaction to what I'm saying is that we all move to the south of France and move into, you know, with a bunch of monks. That's the total wrong reaction. That's an overreaction in the wrong way. That thinking that you can't do life, that you got to hide yourself away and give yourself to that type of life to be able to love the Lord in the first, you know, where the first commandment's first place. No, He said that to a bunch of taxpayers, fishermen, lawyers, and everybody else that was standing around. You know, camel traders and the whole bit. Here's the other thing that I wanted to emphasize. And I mentioned it already. Moses said it's easy for you not to do this. And Paul kind of puts it this way. He talks about the simplicity that was in loving Christ. He says, I'm afraid, it's 2 Corinthians 11, it's on that next to the last page. He says, I'm afraid, least as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, that your minds would be led astray from the simplicity and purity of devotion to Christ. He says, it's simple. He says, it's simple. It's purity of devotion. That means my heart belongs to no one else. It's simple. And I don't reserve any of it for myself. I don't reserve it for the opinions of men. I'm totally loyal in my heart. In fullness. Okay? Not just in part, but in fullness. That's a hard thing for us to grasp, because even though we say we don't compartmentalize our life, we do. Our time's divided, our energy's divided, our emotions are divided. We've not given it fully over to the Lord in that way. Okay, I'm going to close with this. I just want to share a comment about spiritual currency. Here's what I see often happening, and here's what I think we have to change. One of the things we have to change. Typically, our spiritual currency, that is the amount of time, energy, money, and resource that we have to give to spiritual things. That's what I call spiritual currency. We tend to view our life as having X amount of spiritual currency. Okay? Just for the sake of conversation, we will call that 5 units. I have 5 units of spiritual currency. How much can I get in return for that which I'm willing to pay? I have 5 units of spiritual currency, and that's the measure of my thoughts, minds, wills, and emotion, all of that. I have 5 units of that. Here's what I'm willing to spend, and now I want to get as much back in return for that as I can. Let's put it down in terms of minutes. Most people have 20 minutes of spiritual currency a day. They have 20 minutes of spiritual currency. They have 10% of their income. Here's what I'm willing to give to the Lord. What can I get back from Him in return? And here's what the Lord's saying. No, you don't have 20 minutes. You have 168 hours times 80, yay, 90 plus years. That's what you have. How much of that are you willing to spend? And you will get back in proportion. But here's what happens. Everybody says, well, you know, I got this, that, and that, the other to do, and I do this, and yada, 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 and, you know, I just do the devotion, then I fall asleep, and then I can't get to bed at night. And really what it comes down to, you push their buttons, ask the right questions. If they have a devotional life at all, it's no more than 10 or 15 minutes. And their life is totally broke down, and they wonder why. And now they're trying to fix all the breakdowns. That's why the counseling rooms are full. That's why the church is divorced, and that's why half of it's on an antidepressant. Their life is broke. Why is it broke? Your life's out of order. You're not pursuing the first commandment. And here's the deception of it. We all think we are. Because we're sincere in our love, we think we're radically pursuing the first commandment. But you got to hear Moses' word. Moses is saying, nuh-uh, you have to be diligent in this. And to some degree, Rhonda and I live in a community of people who have just shut Western life down and started over. They've quit secular jobs so they can have 4 to 5 hour devotionals. That's crazy. You know, they got 4 to 5 hour devotionals, and their service hours are 4 to 5 hours a day, and they live in a conference. Well, that has an effect. You know, that has an effect. But they've decided, they've made the change. And as best they know how, they're giving their mind, they're giving their will, and here's the big one, I didn't address it earlier, they're giving their strength to it. When we hear the phrase, love the Lord with all your strength, we think about exuberant worship, which is totally wrong. The Jewish mind, when it heard, love the Lord with all your strength, to that Jewish mind, what that meant was servants, descendants, sheep, goats, land, money. That's what his strength was. A person's strength was measured in material goods. And that's what the Lord was saying, love me with all your strength. What if we viewed our house, our money, our resources, our capabilities, our talents, our knowledge of technology, what if we viewed all of that, which is our strength, our ability to impact and influence, what if we viewed all that as a means to love the Lord? What if everybody invested money with the idea of loving the Lord with it? Instead of just getting enough so that at the end of my life and I'm not working, I'll have enough before I die. And if I really get enough, then I can even secure my own medical care and not have to go to a nursing home. I mean, that's the way we think. But the Lord was saying, no, all that stuff that I've given you, I'm asking you to love me with it. Well, right now, I mean, we're totally blank on that. How do we even, my house, how do I love the Lord with my house? And we start going through that, I have people over. Well, okay, I mean, that's, you know, that's a start. But the point is, all of my economic strength, I'm going to use to grow in love towards the Lord. That I'm not saving for myself to gain my own area of influence and strength and impact and all that. And there's you've encountered very, very, very few people who have actually touched that, where they actually see everything that's been given them from the Lord, and that it's fluid and that it can come and go as the Lord pleases. Oh, it's very difficult to save a lifetime, have $300,000 in the bank or five, and have the Lord have full disposal to it however he wants, whenever he wants. We say that we do, but when it really come to it, and you've got to write this 19-year-old kid a $500,000 check because the Lord put it on your heart to do it, we've got 10,000 reasons why that's stupid and immature and reckless. Well, that's really what it comes down to. It's not the Lord's. It's ours. I realize some of that stuff's kind of rubbing us the wrong way this morning. But the point I'm making is, we've not even begun to give ourselves to the first commandment. And what it means to give ourselves to the first commandment is so totally far removed from our experience, we have no grid for what it means to do it. Which is a guarantee that we're not doing it. Which is a guarantee that we're going to give our hearts to something else. Which is a guarantee that it's not going to be well with us and our children. It's a guarantee that our life's going to be broke. And that list of possible clues are almost a guarantee now. You see what I'm saying? And I want to see the church admit this, change their life to go after it, and then, as we're going after it, our hearts are healed in so many ways, so many problems, leadership problems, developmental problems, church growth problems, so many of that disappears, and we're another step closer to being prepared for His return. I want to see the church awake, ready, and emotionally prepared for the Lord's return, and not be caught off guard. And right now, we are not ready for the King's return. The church is not ready. And I think the first order of business is His first commandment. Okay. Let's pray for just a second. We can pick up on this theme again at 2 o'clock and start taking a look at Mary's life. She did it well. Father, we ask that right now that You would just begin to grant revelation. We ask for a spirit of revelation to come right now. Father, we're asking that You would grant us revelation of what it means to love You with all of our mind, all of our heart, all of our soul, all of our strength. I'm asking, Lord, that over the next couple of days that You will reveal to us those areas of our mind, will, soul, and strength that we've reserved for us in our own interest, that we've not given You. Father, You've promised us that we can do this. So I'm asking, Lord, for the revelation of where we need to make change, and I'm asking for the grace to literally walk it out and to begin a life of pursuing the first commandment as first place. And Lord, we look forward to doing it. Father, Your word says that He would have a group of people who loved Him to the same degree that You loved Him. Father, we ask to be that people who love Jesus to the same degree and intensity and depth that You do. Thank You, Lord. Amen.